Dune, House Harkonnen, by Brian Herbert and Kevin J. Anderson, Part 2. This part consists of pages 325 through 603. A man may fight the greatest enemy, take the longest journey, survive the most grievous wound, and still be helpless in the hands of the woman he loves. Zen Sunni Wisdom from The Wandering. Breathless with anticipation, Lietkynes forced himself to move methodically, to make no errors. Though excited about racing for Ferula's hand, if he did not prepare properly for the Mina challenge, he could find his death instead of a wife. Heart-pounding, he dressed in his still suit, fitting it out to retain every drop of moisture, checking all the connections and seals. He rolled his pack, including extra water and food, and took the time to inventory the items in his frem kit. Still tent, paracompass, manual, charts, sand snorkel, compaction tools, knife, binoculars, repair pack. Finally, Leet gathered the maker hooks and thumpers he'd need to summon a worm for the trek across the Great Flat and Habanya Erg to Habanya Ridge. The Cave of Birds was an isolated stopping point for freemen on their travels, for those with no permanent siege. Ferula must have departed 2 days earlier, summoning her own worm as few freemen women could do. She would know the cave was empty. She would be there waiting for Leet, or Warwick, whoever arrived first. Leet bustled around the room adjacent to his parents' chambers. His mother heard the frantic movements, even at such a late hour, and moved the hangings aside. "Why are you preparing for a journey, my son?" He looked at her. "Mother, I am off to win myself a wife." Freeth smiled, her thin lips turning up on her tanned and weathered face. "So Ferula has issued the challenge?" "Yes, and I must hurry." Moving with quick, deft fingers, Freeth rechecked the fastenings on his stillsuit and tied the frem kit to his back, as Leet unfolded charts printed on spice paper, so that he could review geography known only to the freemen. He studied the topography of the desert, the rock outcroppings, the salty basins. Weather records showed where wind patterns and storms were likely to strike. Warwick had a head start, he knew, but his impetuous friend would not have taken as many precautions. Warwick would rush into the challenge and trust his freeman skills. But unexpected problems took time and resources to resolve, and Leet invested these few additional minutes to save time later. His mother kissed him briefly on the cheek. "Remember, the desert is neither your friend nor your enemy. Simply an obstacle. Use it to your advantage." "Yes, Mother. Warwick knows that, too." Harditkynes was nowhere to be found. But then he rarely was. Leet could be gone and return again to Red Wall Siege before the planetologist even understood the importance of his son's contest. When he emerged from the moisture-sealed siege doors to stand on the rugged ridge, Leet took in the vista of sweeping sands lit by the rising moons. He could hear the throbbing beat of a distant thumper. Warwick was already out there. Leet rushed down the steep path toward the open basin, but paused again. Sandworms had broad, well-defined territories, which they defended fiercely. Warwick was already calling a great beast, and it would be a long time before Leet could lure a second worm into the same area. Knowing that, he hiked higher instead, crossed the saddle of the ridge, and descended the other side of the mountains, picking his way toward a shallow basin. Leet hoped he could summon a good maker there, a better one than his friend obtained. As he climbed down the rugged slope, using hands and feet, Leet studied the landscape ahead and found a long dune that faced the open desert. That would be a good place to wait. He planted a thumper downslope and set it working without a delayed timer. He'd have several minutes to plow through the loose sand up the back face of the dune. In the darkness, it would be difficult to see the oncoming ripples of Wormsign. Listening to the thump, thump, thump of the device, he removed tools from his kit, stretched out the telescoping whip rods and maker hooks, then strapped the goads to his back. Always before, when he'd called Worms, there had been spotters and helpers, people to assist him should difficulties arise. But for this challenge, Leetkynes had to do everything himself. He completed each step according to the familiar ritual. He fastened cleats to his boots, removed the ropes, and hunkered down to wait. On the other side of the ridge, Warwick would already be mounted and racing across the great flat. Leet hoped he could make up for lost time. It would take 2, perhaps 3 days to reach the Cave of Birds, and much could happen in that time. He dug his fingertips into the sand and sat absolutely motionless. The night had no wind, no sounds other than the thumper, until finally he heard the static hiss of moving sand, the rumble of a leviathan deep beneath the dunes attracted by the steady beat of the thumper. The worm came closer and closer, with a crest of sand in front of it. "Shai Hulud has sent a big maker," Leet said with a long sigh. The worm circled toward the thumper. Its huge, segmented back rode high, encrusted with debris. The wide ridges were like canyons. Leet froze in awe before scrambling across the slipping sand, holding maker hooks in both hands. Even through his stillsuit nose plugs, he smelled sulfur, burned rock, and the potent acrid esters of melange that oozed from the worm. He raced along as the beast swallowed the thumper. Before the worm could bury itself again, Leet lashed out with one of the maker hooks, securing its glistening end into the leading edge of a ring segment. With all his strength he pulled, spreading the segment to expose pinkish flesh too tender to touch the abrasive sands. Then he held on. Avoiding irritation to the stinging wound between its segments, the worm rolled upward and carried Leet with it. He reached out with his other hand, slapping down a second maker hook and embedding it deeper along the segment. He pulled again to widen the gap. The worm rose in a reflex action, flinching from this further annoyance. Normally, additional Freeman riders would open more ring segments, but Leet was alone. Digging his cleats into the hard flesh of Shai Hulud, he climbed higher, then planted spreaders to keep the segment open. The worm rose out of the sand, and Leet tapped with his first goad to turn the worm around and head onto the sprawling plain of the great flat. Leet held his ropes, finished planting his hooks, and finally stood to look back at the sinuous arc of the worm. The maker was huge. An air of dignity hung about this one, a sense of great antiquity that went to the very roots of the planet itself. Never before had he seen such a creature. He could ride this one for a long time, at great speed. He might yet have a chance of overtaking Warwick. His worm raced across the shifting sands as the two moons rose higher. Leet studied his course, using the stars and constellations, following the tail of the mouse pattern known as Muad'Dib, the one who points the way, so that he always knew his direction. He crossed the rippling track of what might have been another great maker plowing across the great flat. Likely Warwick's own worm, since Shai Hulud rarely traveled on the surface unless provoked. Leet hoped that luck was on his side. After many hours the race took on a monotonous familiarity, and drowsiness filled him. He could doze if he lashed himself to the worm, but Leet didn't dare. He had to remain awake to guide the Leviathan. If Shai Hulud strayed from the direct course, Leet would lose time, and he could no longer afford that. He rode the monster all through the night until the lemon color of dawn tinged the indigo skies, washing away the stars. He kept an alert eye for Harkonnen patrol thopters, though he doubted they would come so far below the 60-degree line. He rode through the morning until, at the hottest point of the day, the enormous worm trembled, thrashed, and fought every attempt to keep it going. It was ready to drop from exhaustion. Leet dared not push it any harder. Worms could be ridden to death, and that would be a bad omen indeed. He steered the long, slithering beast toward an archipelago of rock. Releasing the hooks and spreaders, he sprinted along the ring segments and leaped to safety seconds before the lumbering worm wallowed into the sand. Leet dashed toward the low rocks, which were the only strip of dark coloration in a monotony of whites, tans, and yellows, a barricade that separated one vast basin from another. He huddled under a camouflaged, heat-reflective blanket and set a timer from his Fremkit to allow himself one full hour of sleep. Though his instincts and external senses remained alert, he slept deeply, regaining energy. When he awoke, he climbed over the barrier of rocks to the edge of the vast Habanya Erg. There Leet planted his second thumper and called another worm, a much smaller one, but still a formidable creature that would take him farther on his journey. He rode through the afternoon. Toward dusk, Leet's sharp eyes picked up a faint coloration on the shaded sides of the dunes, a pale gray-green where tendrils of grass wove their roots to stabilize the shifting sands. Freeman had placed seeds here, nurtured them. Even if only one out of 1,000 sprouted and lived long enough to reproduce, his father was making progress. Dune would be green again one day. During the hypnotic thrumming of the worm's passage, hour after hour, he could hear his father lecturing. "Anchor the sand, and we take away one of the wind's great weapons. In some of the climatic belts of this planet, the winds don't top 100 clicks per hour. These we call minimum risk spots. Plantings on the downwind side will build up the dunes, creating larger barriers and increasing the size of these minimum risk spots. In that way, we can achieve another tiny step toward our goal here." Half asleep, Leet shook his head. "Even here, all alone in this vast wasteland, I can't escape the great man's voice, his dreams, his lectures." But Leet had hours left to travel. He had not seen Warwick yet, knew that there were many routes across the wasteland. He did not relent or decrease his speed. Finally, he made out a wavering dark smudge on the far horizon. Habanya Ridge, where lay the Cave of Birds. Warwick left his last worm behind and sprinted with renewed energy up the rocks, using his hands and Temag boots to climb an unmarked trail. The rocks were greenish-black and ochre-red, baked and weathered by the harsh storms of Arrakis. Blowing sands had scoured the face of the cliff, leaving pockmarks and crannies. He couldn't see the cave opening from here, nor should he be able to, since the Freeman could not risk outside eyes spotting it. He had traveled well and called good worms. He had never rested, feeling the need to reach Ferula first, to claim her hand, but also to outperform his friend Leet. It would make a good story for their grandchildren. Already the Freeman Seaches would be talking of the great worm race, how Ferula had issued such an unusual challenge for her Ahal. Warwick climbed hand over hand, finding footholds and finger holds, until he reached a ledge. Near the camouflaged opening, he found a narrow, scuffed footprint from a woman's boot. Ferula's, for certain. No Freeman would have left such a mark accidentally. She had intended to leave that trace. It was her message that she was there, waiting. Warwick hesitated, drew a deep breath. It had been a long journey, and he hoped Leet was safe. His blood brother might be approaching even now, since tall rocks blocked Warwick's view of the surrounding desert. He didn't want to lose his friend, not even over this woman. Fervently he hoped there would not be a fight. But he still wanted to be first. Warwick stepped inside the cave of birds, forming a clear silhouette near the edge of the opening. Inside the rough rock cavern, the shadows blinded him. Finally, he heard a woman's voice, silken words sliding along the walls of the cave.
"It's about time," Farula said.
"I've been waiting for you." She didn't say his name, and for a moment Warwick remained motionless. Then Farula came to him, elfin-faced, her legs and arms long and lean and muscular. Her overlarge eyes seemed to bore into him. She smelled of sweet herbs and potent scents other than melange.
"Welcome, Warwick, my husband."
Taking his hand, she led him deeper into the cave. Nervous, struggling for the right words, Warwick held his head high and removed the stillsuit plugs from his nostrils, while Farula worked at the fastenings of his boots. "Here I redeem the pledge thou gavest," he said, using the ritual words of the Freeman marriage ceremony. "I pour sweet water upon thee in this windless place." Farula picked up the next phrase. "Naught but life shall prevail between us." Warwick leaned closer. "Thou shalt live in a palace, my love."
"Thy enemies shall fall to destruction," she promised him.
"Surely well do I know thee."
"Truly well."
Then they spoke together in unison. "We travel this path together, which my love has traced for thee." At the end of the blessing and the prayer, they smiled at one another. Naib Hainar would perform a formal ceremony when they returned to Redwall Siege. But, in the sight of God and in their own hearts, Warwick and Farula had become married. They stared into each other's eyes for a long time, before withdrawing deeper into the cool darkness of the cave. Leet arrived panting, his boots skittering pebbles along the path as he climbed to the opening of the cave, only to stop when he heard movement within, voices. He hoped it was just that Farula had brought a companion with her, a maidservant perhaps, or a friend, until he recognized the second voice as a man's. "Warwick." He heard them complete the wedding prayer, and knew that according to tradition they were married, and she was now his friend's wife. No matter how much Leet longed for Farula, despite the wish he had made upon seeing the mysterious white beyond, she was lost to him now. Silently he turned and left the ledge to sit in the rock shadows sheltered from the sun. Warwick was his friend, and he accepted defeat gracefully and privately, but with the deepest sadness he could imagine. It would take time and strength to get over this. Leet Kynes waited for an hour, staring across the desert. Then, without venturing inside the cave, he climbed back down to the sand and summoned a worm to take him home. Political leaders often don't recognize the practical uses of imagination and innovative new ideas until such forms are thrust under their noses by bloody hands. Crown Prince Rafael Corino, Discourses on Galactic Leadership. At the Highliner construction site in the deep caverns of Ix, glow globes shed garish shadows and searing reflections along girders. Beams glimmered through a haze of caustic smoke from burned solder and fused alloys. Work bosses shouted commands. Heavy structural plates slammed together with a din that echoed off the rock walls. The downtrodden laborers worked as little as possible, hindering progress and diminishing Tlaloc's profits. Even months after the beginning of construction, the old-design Highliner had not progressed beyond a skeletal framework. In disguise, Kater had joined the construction crew, welding girders and support trusses to reinforce the cavernous cargo bay. Today he needed to be out in the open grotto, where he could see the artificial sky overhead.
where he could watch the latest step in his desperate plan. After the major set of explosions he and Miral had set off 2 years ago, the Masters had become even more repressive, but the Ixians were immune to further hardships. Instead, the example of these two resistance fighters gave their people the strength to endure. Enough rebels, acting alone or in small groups with sufficient determination, constituted a formidable army, and it was a fighting force that no amount of repression could stop. Cut off and unaware of the situation inside Ix, Prince Romber continued to send explosives and other supplies for the resistance. But only one small additional shipment had found its way to Kater and Miral. The Masters opened and inspected every container. The workers at the port of entry canyon had changed, and the ship pilots had been replaced. All of Kater's surreptitious contacts were now lost, and he was isolated again. Still, he and Miral had been heartened to see random windows broken, internal cargoes disrupted, and work productivity diminished even further from its already disgraceful pace. Just a week before, a man who had no connections to politics, who had never called attention to himself, was caught painting garish letters all along a highly traveled corridor. "Death to Tlelaxu Sligs!" Now Kater did a graceful catwalk along a cross girder to reach a floating pad, where he picked up a sonic welder. He ascended via lift platform to the top framework of the highliner and looked down the kilometers-long grotto. Below him, surveillance pods avoided the framework of the highliner and studied labor troops under the cavern lights. The others on Kater's construction squad continued their tasks, unaware of what was about to happen. A welder in coveralls moved closer to Kater, and with a quick peripheral glance he noted that it was Miral, in her own disguise. They would see this together. Any moment now. The embedded holoprojectors in the artificial sky flickered. Clouds from the Tlelaxu homeworld were dotted with skyscraper islands that protruded downward, glittering with light. Once those buildings had appeared to be crystal stalactites. Now the fairyland structures looked like old, chipped teeth set into the rock of the Ixian crust. With Miral standing nearby, Kater squatted on the girder, listening to hammering construction sounds that echoed with tinny reverberations. He looked up like an ancient wolf staring at the moon, waiting. Then the illusory picture of the sky shifted, distorted, and changed color, as if the alien clouds were gathering in a false storm. The holoprojectors flickered and shifted to project a completely different image, one taken from faraway Caladan. The close-up of a face filled the sky like a titanic godhead. Romber had changed greatly during 18 years of exile. He looked much more mature, more regal, with a hard edge to his stare and determination in his deep voice. "I am Prince Romber Vernius," the projection boomed, and everyone stared upward, gaping in awe. His mouth was as large as a guild frigate, his lips opening and closing to dispense words like commandments from on high. "I am the rightful ruler of Ix, and I will return to lead you from your suffering." Gasps and cheers erupted from all the Ixians. From their perch, Kater and Miral saw Sardaukar moving about in confusion, and Commander Garon shouting to his troops to impose order. On balconies high above, Tlelaxu masters emerged, gesturing. Guards raced back into the administrative buildings. Kater and Miral enjoyed the moment, allowing themselves an exchange of bright smiles.
"We did it," she said.
Words that were heard only by him in the confusion around them. It had taken the pair weeks to study the systems well enough to hijack the projector controls. No one had thought to prepare for such a clever sabotage, such a manipulative invasion of their daily environment. In the solitary shipment that got through, Romber Vernius had smuggled the recorded message, hoping they could secretly disseminate it to loyal Ixians. The prince had suggested talking posters or coded message bursts inside the regular communication systems of the underground city. But the enterprising guerrilla couple had chosen to do something far more memorable. To Morale's credit, this had been her idea, and Kater had perfected many of the details. Romber's face was wide and squarish, his eyes glittering with a passion any other exiled leader would envy. His blonde hair had just the right ragged edge to give him a noble yet disheveled appearance. The prince had learned a great deal about statecraft during his years with House Atreides. "You must rise up and overthrow these foul slave masters. They have no legal right to give you orders or manipulate your daily lives. You must help me return Ix to its former glory. Remove this disease called the Bennett Clelox. Band together and use whatever means necessary to..." Romber's words cut off, stuttering, as someone worked the override controls in the main administrative complex. But the prince's voice crackled through again, insistent. "Shall return. I merely await the proper time. You are not alone. My mother was murdered. My father has vanished from the Imperium. But my sister and I remain, and I watch Ix. I intend to..." Romber's image twisted and finally faded into static. A darkness blacker than imaginable night settled on the underground grotto. The Tleilaxu had chosen to shut down the whole sky rather than let Prince Romber complete his speech. But Kater and Miral continued smiling in the inky shadows. Romber had said enough, and his listeners would imagine a grander rallying cry than anything the exiled prince could have actually said. Within seconds, white-hot glow globes burst into luminescence, emergency lights that dazzled like harsh suns inside the cavern. Alarms sounded, but already the downtrodden Ixians chattered among themselves, inspired. Now they attributed the explosions to the power of Prince Romber. They had seen the continued disruptive activities, and this projected speech was the grandest gesture of all. It was true, they thought. Perhaps Prince Romber even walked among them in disguise. House Vernius would return and drive away the evil Tleilaxu. Romber would bring happiness and prosperity back to Ix. Even the suboids were cheering below. With bitter wryness, Kater remembered that these dull bio-engineered workers had been among those responsible for driving out Earl Vernius. Their foolish unrest and unwise gullibility in believing Tleilaxu promises had led to the overthrow in the first place. Kater didn't mind, though. He would accept any ally who was willing to fight. Sardaukar troops swarmed out, weapons evident, shouting for everyone to return to their dwellings. Booming loudspeakers declared an immediate crackdown and full martial law. Rations would be cut in half. Work shifts would be increased. The Tleilaxu had done it all many times before. Following Miral and others, Kater climbed down from the highliner girders to the safety of the cavern floor. The more the invaders squeezed, the more outraged the Ixians would become, until at last they would reach the eruption point. Commander Kando Garon, the leader of Imperial troops on Ix, shouted through a voice projector in battle language. Sardaukar fired blasts into the air to frighten the laborers. Kater moved among his companions on the construction squad, meekly allowing himself to be herded into a holding area. At random, some would be detained and questioned, but no one could prove his involvement or Miral's. Even if both of them were executed for this, their grand gestures had been worth everything. Kater and Miral, widely separated in the throng, did as they were told, following the angry orders of Sardaukar guards. When Kater heard workers whispering to each other, repeating the words of Romber Vernius, his joy and confidence reached its peak. Someday, someday soon, Ix would be restored to its people. Enemies strengthen you,
Allies weaken. Emperor Elrud IX. Deathbed Insights. After he recovered from the ink vine beating, Gurney Halleck worked for 2 months with a sluggish sense of inner dread, worse than he had ever experienced in the slave pits. An ugly scar ran along the side of his jaw, thrashing lines that throbbed a beet-red color and continued to hurt. Though the actual wound had healed, the toxic residue still pulsed with neural fire, as if an intermittent lightning bolt lay buried within his cheek and jaw. But that was only pain. Gurney could endure that. Physical injuries meant very little to him anymore. They had become part of his existence. He was more frightened by the fact that he had been punished so minimally after he'd attacked Glossu Raban. The burly Harkonnen had whipped him, and the guards had beaten him afterward so that he'd needed 3 days in the infirmary. But he had experienced much worse for only minor infractions. What did they really have in mind? He remembered the dull gleam of calculated cruelty in Raban's close-set eyes. Check the records. Find out where he came from. And if he has any family left alive. Gurney feared the worst. With the other slaves, he wandered through the days mechanically, hunched over with a growing anticipation and horror in the pit of his stomach. He worked alternately on the cliffs of Mount Ebony and in the obsidian processing vats. Cargo ships landed near the garrison and the slave pits, hauling away containers filled with glowing, sharp-edged volcanic glass to be distributed by House Hagal. One day, a pair of guards unceremoniously hauled him from the vats. He dripped with dark suspension fluids. Half-clad, splattering oily liquid on the uniformed guards, Gurney stumbled out into the open square where Glossu Raban had inspected the prisoners, where Gurney had attacked him. Now he saw a low platform on the ground, and in front of it, a single chair. No chains, no sugar wire bindings, just the chair. The sight struck terror into his heart. He had no idea what might be in store for him. Guards shoved him into the chair, then stepped away. A doctor from the prison infirmary stood at attention nearby, and a group of Harkonnen soldiers marched into the square. The other slaves continued working in the pits and tanks. So Gurney knew the impending event was personal, a spectacle arranged only for him. That made it infinitely worse. The more Gurney showed his agitation, the more pleasure the guards took in refusing to answer him. So he fell silent, as the thick processing liquid dried into a crackling film on his skin. The familiar doctor stepped up, holding a small yellow vial with a tiny needle at one end. Gurney had seen those yellow vials in the infirmary, stored in a transparent case, but he'd never had occasion to receive one. The doctor slapped the pointed end against the prisoner's neck as if he were crushing a wasp. Gurney jerked up, throat clenched, muscles straining. Warm numbness spread like hot oil through his body. His arms and legs grew leaden. He twitched a few times, then couldn't move at all. He couldn't turn his neck, couldn't grimace, couldn't blink or even move his eyes. The doctor shifted the chair and twisted Gurney's head as if positioning a mannequin, forcing him to stare at the low platform in front of him. Gurney suddenly realized what it was. A stage. And he would be compelled to watch something. From one of the outbuildings, Glossu Raban emerged, fully dressed in his finest uniform and accompanied by the work supervisor, who also wore a dark, clean uniform. The scrawny, pot-bellied man had eschewed his nostril filters for the occasion. Raban stepped in front of Gurney, who wanted nothing more than to leap to his feet and throttle the man. But he couldn't move. The paralysis drug held him like a vice, so he simply put as much hatred into his eyes as he could manage. "Prisoner," Raban said, his thick lips wearing an obscene smile. "Gurney Halleck of the village Dimitri. After you attacked me, we took the trouble to find your family. We've heard from Captain Kriubi about the obnoxious little songs you were singing in the tavern. Even though no one had seen you in the village for years, they never thought to report your disappearance. A few of them, before they died under torture, said that they assumed we'd taken you away in the night. The fools!"
Gurney felt panicked now, with fluttering dark wings in his mind. He wanted to demand answers about his tired and unambitious parents, but he feared Raban would tell him anyway. He could barely breathe. His chest muscles spasmed, fighting the paralysis. As his blood boiled and his rage grew, he was unable to draw in more breath. His head began to buzz from lack of oxygen.
"Then all the pieces fell into place. We learned about how your sister had been assigned to the pleasure houses, and you just couldn't accept the natural order of things."
Raban shrugged his broad shoulders. His fingers strayed meaningfully to his ink-vine whip, but did not pull it free.
"Everyone else knows his place on Gedi Prime, but you don't seem to know yours. So we've decided to provide a reminder, just for you."
He gave a theatrically heavy sigh that emphasized his disappointment.
"Unfortunately, my troops were a bit too enthusiastic when they asked your parents to join us here. I'm afraid your mother and father did not survive the encounter. However..."
Raban raised one hand, and the guards hurried to the supply shack. Out of his field of view, Gurney heard a scuffle and then a woman's wordless cry, but he could not turn to see. He knew it was Beth. For a moment his heart skipped a beat, just to know she was still alive. He thought the Harkonnens might have killed her after his capture in the pleasure house. But now he knew in his soul that they'd only been saving her for something much worse. They dragged her, thrashing and struggling, onto the wooden platform. She wore only a baggy, torn shirt. Her flaxen hair was long and wild, her eyes wide with fear, and even more so once she caught sight of her brother. Again he saw the white scar on her throat. They had stolen Beth's ability to sing or to talk, and had destroyed her ability to smile. Their gazes locked. Beth couldn't speak. Paralyzed, Gurney could not say anything to her, or even flinch.
"Your sister knows her place," Raban said. "In fact, she served us rather well. I checked through the records to come up with an exact number. This little girl has provided pleasure to 4,620 of our troops."
Raban patted Beth on the shoulder. She tried to bite him. He clenched his fingers and tore off the shift she wore. The guards forced her naked onto the platform, and Gurney couldn't move. He wanted to shut his eyes, but the paralysis prevented him. Though he understood what she had been forced to do for the past 6 years, seeing her nakedness again offended and appalled him. Her body was bruised, her skin a patchwork of dark colors and thin scars.
"Not many women at our pleasure houses last as long as she has," Raban said. "This one has a strong will to live, but her time is at an end. If she could speak, she'd tell us how very happy she is to give this one last service to House Harkonnen, providing a lesson to you."
Gurney strained with all of his might, trying to force his muscles to move. His heart pounded, and heat pulsed through his body. But he could not so much as wiggle a finger. The work supervisor went first. He opened his robes, and Gurney had no recourse but to watch as the pot-bellied man raped Beth on the stage. Then came five of the other guards, performing at Raban's command. The broad-shouldered brute observed Gurney as much as he observed the spectacle on the stage. Inside his mind, Gurney flew into a rage, then wished fervently to be allowed to retreat, to call down black sleep upon himself. But he didn't have that option. Raban himself went last, taking the greatest pleasure. He was forceful and brutal,
though by then Beth had been abused nearly into unconsciousness. As he finished, Rabban locked his hands around Beth's neck, around the white scar. She struggled again, but Rabban twisted her head, forcing her to look over at her brother as he squeezed his hands around her throat. He thrust once more inside her, viciously, and then the muscles in his arms went tense. He squeezed harder, and Beth's eyes bulged. Gurney had no choice but to watch as she died in front of him. Doubly satisfied, Rabban stood, stepped back, and redressed himself in his uniform. He smiled at both of his victims. "Leave her body here," he said. "How long will her brother's paralysis last?" The doctor approached quickly, unmoved by what he had just seen. Another hour or two at that small dosage. Any more of the curare would have put him into a hibernation trance, and you didn't want that. Rabban shook his head. "Let's leave him here to stare at her until he can move again. I want him to consider the error of his ways." Laughing, Rabban departed and the guards followed. Gurney remained alone in the chair, completely unshackled. He could not cease staring at the motionless form of Beth sprawled on the platform. Blood trickled from her mouth. But even the paralysis that gripped Gurney's body could not prevent the tears that spilled from his eyes. The mystery of life is not a problem to be solved, but a reality to be experienced. Meditations from Bifrost Erie, Buddhist-Islamic text. For a year and a half, Abelard Harkonnen remained a broken man. He hid his face in shame from the horror of what his son had done. He accepted the blame and the guilt, but he could not bear to meet the haunted eyes of the good people of Lankavile. As he had feared, after Rabban's slaughter of Bjondak's whales in Tula Fjord, the fishing had gone bad. Villages were abandoned as the fishermen and fur whale hunters moved on. Left exposed to the elements, the wooden settlements remained empty, a string of ghost towns in rocky coves. Abelard had dismissed his servants, and he and Emmy shut down the main lodge, leaving it like a tombstone to memorialize their once idyllic way of life. They departed from the grand old building in hopes that one day the good times would return. For now he and his wife lived in their small dacha, out on an isolated spit of land that extended into the blood-tainted waters of the fjord. Emmy, who had been so hale and hearty with laughing eyes and a common-sense smile, now seemed old and tired, as if the knowledge of their corrupted son sapped her remaining strength. She had always been firmly anchored in the world, like a bedrock, but her foundation had been badly eroded. Glossu Rabban was 41 years old, an adult responsible for his own horrific actions.